Welcome to Work of Art, the Mason Gross podcast, produced out of Rutgers University's Mason Gross School of the Arts in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We are a community of nearly 1,200 undergrad and graduate dancers, musicians, theater artists, filmmakers, and visual artists from around the globe. My name is Laurie Granieri, and I'll be sitting down with some of these artists, discussing what fuels their curiosity, their passion, and their impulse to make. Screenwriter and director Danielle Lesovitz, on faculty here at the Rutgers Filmmaking Center, uses her platform to dive deep into the lives of the rootless and the marginalized. She teases out threads of darkness and violence, as well as moments of connection and transcendence, among inhabitants of a mobile home park in her script for the 2017 feature Mobile Homes. In her full-length directorial debut, Port Authority, Lesovitz delves into New York City's Kiki ballroom scene, in which homeless youth of color compete through gender non-conforming dance forms, such as voguing. Through Lesovitz's lens, community and family can be forged in multiple ways, and grace can be found in places that, at first glance, appear unlikely to offer up much in the way of grace at all. Port Authority, shot in the fall of 2018, counts Martin Scorsese as its executive producer. Several Rutgers film students worked on the project and are joining Lesovitz this month at the Cannes Film Festival in France, where the project will be screened. The movie follows Paul, a 20-something white Midwesterner who arrives at New York City's Port Authority bus station, searching for a family member who never appears. He quickly falls in love with Y, a girl he encounters voguing on the sidewalk. But when Paul discovers Y is trans, he is forced to examine who he is, where he belongs, and what he believes. Danielle, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
To be here. I know you're busy. You know, I want to dive into a little bit of what I was alluding to in the intro, because you've mentioned this before too, that you're very interested in the marginalized and the rootless. I know that you grew up the daughter of a single mom, mm-hmm. in and out of public housing. Mm-hmm. How did that situation in your childhood inform your choice of subject matter?
I mean, I think it informed my source of subject matter, but also just the fact that I am a filmmaker. I think it was having a lot of these outsider experiences very early on, and not being able to articulate them very well, not feeling understood in certain ways, forced me to kind of rise to the occasion to try to process things for myself in a way that I could relate them to other people, and people could relate to me. So it's, I think, just a process of wanting to connect, really, and finding that in films and in stories, we can sometimes talk about ourselves and our lives and our experiences in a coded way that allows for us to connect with the experiences of others and for others to connect with us.
Why did you choose film as your lens, as your way of, as you said, using kind of a coded way of getting at your experiences, as opposed to writing?
And... Right. Film is so close to life in that it's, you know, we're taking photographs of real things in real time and we're putting them together, but it's also so dreamlike, and it's really sophisticated in its ability to allow for internal life while watching something that feels and looks very real, and it, if done well, it can be so powerful. I don't know why I didn't choose prose or writing, or I don't know why I didn't choose that. I think I like the musicality of film, and I like how emotional it can be in unexpected ways. I also, it's just interesting too that the one thing I did with my mother growing up was see films. like every weekend we saw a film. So there might be something in that of just like it became like just a ritual and a big part of my childhood. So
what did you see?
Oh, everything. I think I saw Harry Met Sally. I think I was 5. So my mom was really open to taking me to independent cinema, to foreign films, to to other sort of Hollywood films. But I mean, even at an early age, I remember having some detachment while watching films and critiquing performances and observing lensing and at very early ages. But I never imagined me being a filmmaker or a film director, because that was something, you know, like rich white men did or something like this. That was sort of my thought, and it was just a very ridiculous idea. But that changed over time.
How did it change?
How did it change?
How did you make the leap from saying, that's not for me, to, okay, I could approach this. This could be mine too.
You know, what's funny is I never really did. So it's like, instead of like looking at the top of the mountain saying, oh, I want to be a director, it was sort of one step at a time. I think in college, I was interested in documentary work because I liked the anthropological aspect of it. I liked sort of observing and understanding these stories of others. And then, you know, outside of college, I'm like, oh, can I make a living doing this? Is this something that's sustainable? So I tried to have a production company where I made these documentaries on artists for galleries. And that was fairly sustainable. It was a little shaky, but I could live. And then it was like, well, you know, could I write as something? I'm wondering, because, you know, sometimes there are stories that I see in the documentaries. I wish documentaries evolved in this way, and they don't. So can I write something? And then you try a short film, and then you're like, oh, that was pretty good. Maybe I want to do a feature film. And it just is like this. And then you're like, well, maybe I think I need to go to film school for that. So you go to film school, and then bit by bit, you're like, well, can I do this? And you're sort of testing what you can do. And then at film school, it was sort of like, in the program, I sort of developed reputation, but I was known as a strong writer. And so people would ask me to write for them or to give them notes. And I had professors being like, you should be a writer, you should be a writer. So it's like, okay. So that's where sort of the mobile homes came into play. You know, my classmate asked me to write for them. And then once I saw that process, I was like, why am I not directing? It felt very natural in terms of having, you know, going from writing to directing. So it was one of those questions like, oh, can I do that? So it's more of like, instead of saying, I want to do that, it's like, can I do this? And just kind of testing the boundaries of what's possible, what the world will let you do a little bit.
I love hearing you talk about this, how you followed this, because it's certainly not a vector path, right? Even hearing you talk, it seems as if you're really willing to follow your curiosity and just kind of with a shrug and say, well, let's see. But not everyone's like that. What makes you courageous enough to do that?
I don't understand why everyone's not that way. But even, I mean, there are lots of periods along this process where people are like, this is ridiculous. And I'm like, but why? Why is it ridiculous?
Well, what do you think is ridiculous? Give me an example.
Well, the producer on this project is French. She's not American. I know her from Mobile Homes. When we started working together, she didn't speak English really that well. My partner speaks French, and I speak a little bit of French. But so there are ways of connecting. But people, when they saw us as a duo, they were like, how is this French producer who doesn't speak English going to produce an American film? Our producer hadn't even been to New York, right, in her life. She had never, maybe she had been to the U.S., I'm not sure, but it's like, how is she going to produce a film in the U.S. on this subject? You know, it's sort of like, you two are crazy. And we both looked at each other, we're like, why? Why is this crazy? We don't understand why it's crazy. So maybe it's being naive, but maybe it's also having a certain faith or trust. And if you just do things step by step, eventually you'll accumulate enough insight or understanding of a situation to be able to do it. Never once was my like faith in the ability to do it questioned. I never for myself, it just seemed very obvious and easy somehow. I don't know where that comes from, but yeah.
Not to harp too much on your childhood, but I can imagine that there were some hard moments there for you and for your mom, and some moments of what people would see as instability. Am I reaching too much to think that would make you brave, because you got through that?
Well, I think, that's true. Like maybe there is something special in my bravery that I'm maybe not acknowledging. So my parents had a very volatile relationship, and my mother kind of took me. We were in San Francisco, and she sort of took me to Kansas and thought, okay, we're going to be safe here. And she had basic education. I think she stayed home economics in college or something like this, but she really had to figure out a way to support both herself and me. And I was along for the ride. You know, I saw someone go from not thinking, you know, having the ambition of being a kind of a housewife to having to support a child and themselves on their own. And I think maybe watching her do that, I just remember watching her going to nursing school and watching her become a nurse and watching her dealing with that profession, maybe kind of showed me that things are possible and think crazy things are possible. And it is ridiculous for me to think that she went from really being on welfare with me and having to sort of do some crazy stuff just in terms of, I mean, to balance going to school and a kid and survival is very complicated. But to do that, then to her having like sent me to a very, you know, nice private undergrad university in the span of like 18 years going from this to that, I think is pretty remarkable of her. So I think having like that strong role model probably gives me a sense of fearlessness. But also I was a platform, like springboard and platform diver growing up. So like 10 meters and 3 meters. And it was my passion. And every day there was this crazy thing, crazy fear you had to confront or push through. So I it might have been just from the age of like 5 to 16 having to do things that I was very uncomfortable doing repeatedly, maybe brought down the threshold of fear for now. If I'm afraid of something at this point, I see it as a challenge, or it's interesting to me rather than actually responding out of fear to something. And maybe that's just a relationship I've built with fear over having, you know, having to do crazy things from very high places repeatedly. So it could be those two factors. If I had to think about it, those two factors probably played heavily into what you seem to think is a kind of fearlessness, but for me is just a very natural approach to going through life.
Were you one of those, and I wasn't one of these kids, so this always seems foreign to me, one of those kids who would just sort of easily leap off of a platform, or did you really have to confront a lot? Did you have to work through something as you were going off the board or going off the platform?
Yeah, that's so interesting, actually. I would, maybe this is very intimate knowledge, but it was terrifying to me. Like, you know, learning a new dive, like you would have to do like an inward 2.5, something like this, up to 3 meter. And that's like, you're standing on the board backwards, 3 meters high, and you have to do 2.5 forward flip, so your head actually like goes towards the board and you flip, and you know there's so many possibilities of like being disoriented in the air or like not getting your arms through on time so that you're too close to the board and you hit the board, and there's all of these moments, and you have to collect yourself every single time you do it. Even if you've done it 1,000 times, you have to collect yourself, you have to teach yourself to be incredibly present in that moment, and you have to allow yourself to rely on muscle memory. So it's a bit of practicing how to let go of the desire to control something and to be open to your body, some sort of deeper knowledge or awareness expressing itself through you. I remember going to sleep every night practicing my dives in my head. So I do a lot of visualization and also this sort of mantras of like, you can do it, you can do it, you can do it, to the point where I would believe. It's like if you repeat it enough, you start to believe in it. So there's yeah, the way I found to get over those scary moments was to, it became about transcending the fear through some kind of faith in something bigger than myself, something I couldn't know or control, but that's something that I could trust. And that, I think, that is still there with me for sure.
How has that presence and that trust in something bigger, in something that you don't know,
right,
informed your filmmaking?
It informs, these are really interesting questions because it informs the filmmaking on every single level. So when you pick a subject, right, there's a certain amount of, you pick a subject, and of course, like, I have my partner who's also a creative collaborator. When I gave her the idea, she was like, this is great, you should do it. But you, when you pick the subject, you know that you're going to spend the next 3 to 4 years of your life. So you don't know if it's a good idea. So there's a lot of fear. Is this a good idea or not? But you have to trust that even if it's a bad idea, you will find a way or an angle of turning it into something powerful. So there's that first leap of faith that you make. Okay, this is the next 3 years of my life. I don't know if it's going to amount to anything, but I'm going to go. Then the writing process, and I deal with this a lot with students too, the writing process is all about trusting your instinct. It's about writing from a place where you're not actually aware of what you're writing. You have to really let go of that. And there's probably some psychological term. I don't know if it's like the superego or something. There is an aspect of your brain that is constantly critiquing yourself and constantly commenting on what it is that you're doing and judging. And you have to be able to silence that part of your brain so that something else emerges. And so again, in the writing, it's about that faith. Of course, in the editing process, it's a little bit different because that's when you're saying, okay, that's crazy, I don't want that out there, but to be intentional about it. So when you're writing, it's like leap of faith moment, going into that, like, something is writing this, but it's not me. And that's how I feel about, for sure, that's how I feel about the film. Is something wrote it? I was there, I was present to it. Was it me? Probably it was me, but do I relate to it as me? Not really. I'm more connected to the other thing, that's that mysterious thing, and I let it be mysterious, that's sort of guiding the process. And then at every decision you're making in directing, from casting, from who you're working with, from locations, all of these, these decisions are not made from any kind of logical place. They're really, it's just a sixth sense. You're like, does this feel right or not? And that again is trusting some deeper impulse, and letting that be your guide, really. Throughout the entire process, you're kind of leaning on that thing.
What is it they say? You have to be hot and then you have to be cold. You have to have that scrupulous eye, yeah, at the end and turn that on, but not too soon.
Right, exactly. Yeah, that last pass is the militant, I'm going to cut away anything that's a little bit indulgent or a little bit not working or not serving the story or all these things. But the process is the generating of the material is very, you know, intuitive and warm and, yeah.
How do you impart this to your students? I know you had several students who worked on this film with you. Is this an important thing to impart to them?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the process of learning how to what is that saying? It's how to get out of the way of yourself. I think that's so important to any young filmmaker. I see it all the time. I mean, students are terrified to show their work. And they're afraid of being humiliated, and they're afraid of themselves, and they're like, you know, they, you see the torture, and you know, I don't know how we develop these skills. Maybe it's through pushing. You know, sometimes I question pedagogically, should I be hard on them or should I be supportive of them? And I've taken the supportive route, Because sometimes when you have someone telling you you can't do it, you know, like, yeah, you shouldn't do it this way, you actually rise to the occasion. And sometimes when you have someone saying, guys, like, really, don't be afraid, don't worry, just follow. It's so, maybe don't include this, I don't know. But, like, I find that class can be a bit like therapy in that the students are showing parts of themselves that are very... they're potentially very vulnerable in showing them, and that's a good thing. But to create a space where the students, their classmates are commenting on their work in a way that's supportive, and just sort of understanding that the work you make at the beginning of your career is going to not be your best work, and it's going to have a lot of problems with it, and that's good because you learn from that. And it's part of, it's a part of detaching who you are from the work that you make. And once you can sort of say, well, I am myself and the work is the work, and there's a kind of separation between the two, so that when I show my work, I'm not being personally judged, it's just the work that's being judged. Then suddenly it's much easier, I think, for the students to progress, for the comments to come and to have that sense of protection and safety while putting yourself in a vulnerable place in terms of showing things about yourself that might be uncomfortable for you.
That's huge, because I do hear a lot of professors saying, my students are so careful. Mm. My students are so careful, and I wish they weren't so careful. Mm-hmm. But you can kind of understand why that happens over the years to a student in mm-hmm. in the educational system. So what you're doing, in my mind, is very important.
I hope so. I was also surprised by every student. They're like, I don't want to do the work because I think it's gonna be bad. I'm like, it should be bad. Like, dare to be bad. Like, dare to fail. If you're not failing, you're not learning. And right now, I just, like, right now, fail, because there's safety nets on you, there's guards, you're not going to hurt yourself if you fail. If you do that, maybe in the world, it's going to be more traumatizing, and it might make you want to quit. So do it now. Understand that you can, like, you can be resilient to that, you can stand up, it's not a big deal.
So, you know, you know all the stats, I'm sure. Things don't tend to look so good for women in the film industry, right? Women in Hollywood, an initiative that advocates for gender diversity and inclusion in Hollywood, reports that of the top 100 grossing films of 2018, women represented only 4% of directors and 15% of writers. What are you seeing out there?
I mean, when I hear something like that, it excites me, because again, it's like such a challenge, right? A lot has shifted in the last few years. I think suddenly I don't know if it's trendy, but it's, people are making real efforts for representation, and I feel honored and privileged and grateful and fortunate to be at this stage where it's like, okay, I have a feature film that's ready to go, and all of a sudden doors are opening that did not open just a few years ago. So it's a really great time to be a woman in film right now, actually, even though the statistics might suggest something else. So for me, it's exciting. I mean, the fact that the storytellers of our civilization, can we say that, are men, are not surprising, because the stories are, I don't know, the culture that we live in and the stories that we've heard historically are from a male perspective. So it makes sense that this sort of, it would be self-perpetuating, in that the stories are of men, from a male perspective, so it's men who keep telling them. And it's, you know, even just finding, so we talk about, it's difficult to find female directors, it's difficult to find, for sure, female financiers. I haven't met a female financier yet, maybe that exists. It's also very difficult to find female critics. So these sort of gatekeepers of cultural prestige and legacy, those don't exist either. So it's not an issue of just like a lack of women writers and directors. It's so pervasive, and that every kind of professional dimension of this industry is steeped in a kind of masculine perspective. But what's cool about it is I think we're becoming aware of that. And I think it's one of those things, like in our culture, we're becoming aware of this sort of bias, and in the stories we tell, we're becoming aware of the bias, and how we look at or understand those stories, we're understanding the bias. And for me, that's really exciting.
Well, you know, I'm thinking about the fact that you're going to Cannes with 4 students, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And I know one of them is a woman. Why is it important for you to...
And one of them identifies as trans as well.
Okay.
Which is interesting, yeah.
For sure. And I'm wondering why it's important for you to bring along film students to Cannes, and what do you think that will mean for them beyond a vacation to France?
I think part of my job here at Rutgers is demystifying filmmaking. It was always, you know, it's always seen as, again, for me too, the reason why I didn't just jump into it was because it was something I never thought existed for me to participate in. So when you, the further you go in the process of making a film, the more you realize that it's actually not that complicated, and that it is entirely, how do you say, it's not like superhero geniuses who are directing films, it's just ordinary people who have stories to tell and the resources to tell them. So demystifying that first feature and having students understand that for the most part they possess most of the talent and skills to do something like this. It's just a matter of kind of working hard, really. So I think my goal with this is to say work hard, because it's you're not far off, really. On some level you're not far off. So I think it does that. But also for me, we talk about this as like me benefiting students, but I also think having young minds who don't maybe know the rules or the language of cinema as well as other people, but who have ideas and who have things to say, I think it does something to a crew. It reminds us sometimes of like who we were when we started out, and the enthusiasm and the hopes and the dreams, and I think it gives for you know, for all of us a kind of sense of it reminds us of, you know, why we're doing what we're doing in terms of who we were at that age.
Well, you know, going back to Port Authority for a second, going back to the story, I know you mentioned that rooting this story in the experience of a white Midwestern guy,
mm-hmm.
like Paul, navigating certain ambiguities is especially important now. I want to hear more about that. Why was it important to use him as the vessel?
It's less about like, here's this guy who's entering this world and who we're watching through the story, and it's more about what does it mean to be a man, and what is that, and are there oppressive aspects of manhood for men? Because if you navigate through life as a woman and people treat you as a woman, you realize you have, you know, obviously you don't have male privilege, but you have opportunities for warmth and hugs and touch and connection, and you can be vulnerable and you can cry and you can, you know, be a little bit emotional or dramatic, and you're not judged for it and you're not imposing a kind of self-judgment on it. So what does it look like if you can't do those things, and how then do you express yourself, and does violence occur, and do you get to be a whole self? So I think now we can tell stories of men, not from a male perspective, but say, hey, you might be missing out on this other thing here that you might not be aware of, so let me write a story about that, because I see that in the world.
I know, you know, you said you often rely on non-actors. What do you think they bring to a project that professionals can't?
I think it's just part of my process when I feel a little bit like a painter, you know, and if you're painting someone who is a professional at being a subject of a painting, it's harder to discover things. Whereas if you're just looking at someone who you get to paint, you can actually, at least for me, I get to discover things, and then I can highlight that discovery in my lensing, or I can be more present. I'm forced to be present. I'm forced to observe, and I'm forced to capture what happens in a way that I can't predict. And for me, it just, it's much nicer. I also, when I'm casting people who really inspire me and who feel like the characters that I've written, and then I kind of let them do their thing with it. But to be able to collaborate like this with real people in a fictional space is just so satisfying. It, instead of being in your head and trying to make this thing, this like perfect thing, you're in a kind of wilderness and you're trying to survive it. And it's just much more satisfying and fulfilling. And I think it's also an opportunity for, that's how you show in an easy way something very new, right? It's you find something in the world that you haven't seen in cinema before, either a character or a culture or something, and you just make a story about it, and you take the people who, you know, who haven't been seen, and you show them. So it's very easy to, yeah, to open up new space in the medium that way.
I just can't really imagine you in a director's chair with sunglasses on and your name stitched across the back of the director's chair as kind of this lionized figure.
No,
you know, this, and I'm seriously, you know, heaping on hyperbole in terms of the director's, the icon of the director, but how do you think you're different from the white male director you
right.
were, you felt was so far from you as a child in the movies?
Yeah, I have no desire to be an authority figure on set either. I have no interest in that. I don't understand the sort of hierarchical nature of filmmaking. There are a lot of, and I don't try to either. I'm not sitting here trying to be a director. I'm just being myself. We have a job. There's a film we need to make. Let's figure out how to make it. I don't know if it's a feminine thing, but I want to collaborate with people in a very democratic environment. And I know that there's one person who kind of needs to be responsible for all of those things. But I don't understand why I would need to be, why it would need to be so, how do you say it? Probably if it's a larger scale, obviously the hierarchy and the structure works well, but for something like this, it just doesn't feel necessary to separate myself from the group and to be this top down leader.
And you feel you can still have your stamp on this piece, even if you don't think of yourself as the one.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's always a balance to know when to fight for something and when not to fight for something, or when something's really important to you, or when you can let go. But I do think that there's something, if you let yourself, you know, if you choose your collaborators well, then they're going to influence the project in their territory. So your DP is going to influence the image, and your costume designer is going to do their thing, and you're going to guide them, but you're going to trust them too. And then when you put everything together, you're getting something that's quite different than what you expected, right? So it's not about like, this is my vision, it needs to be this way. It's sort of like, these are the colors that we're playing with, and the color that we're making is maybe different than the shade I wanted, but it's its own new beautiful shade. Like, there was something new that was made here, and I'm going to make this thing as incredible as it can be, without imposing myself too much on it, but just making this thing here work in terms of how the, in terms of staying consistent to the intention of the work, if that makes sense.
For sure. I just keep thinking the whole being greater than the parts, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And being surprised
by
what comes through. I'm wondering what it's like, though, to have the imprimatur of someone like Scorsese, who might be seen as more of that, you know, that old guard at this point.
But how cool is it of him to open up space like that, right?
He has so much enthusiasm.
Yeah.
Like a kid.
Right.
It's so inspiring.
I think he's someone who's just intellectually constantly curious. And he has that openness. And it's not to say that that form of filmmaking or that sort of top-down thing is bad. I'm not here to judge it. It's, we've had so many wonderful films, I mean, almost all of them are made that way. It's just to say that not everyone is made to make work that way. And so, you know, what's the harm in trying a different model, that sort of thing. But it means a lot, you know, it's sort of like, ushering in a new generation, and again, he's not dictating in any way how something should be, or he's very, very hands off. And I just think that that relationship between older generations of filmmakers and younger generations is so special and nice and wonderful, and I feel very privileged to have someone as incredible as Martin Scorsese back and support the project. I mean, I think it's just a testimony to him, really, more than anything else. So, yeah. And I don't know how aware he is or was of our newer, let's say, relationships with gender and gender expression. And I think perhaps for him, it's also a learning experience in that way, too. So, I mean, even just... It was so interesting because the film is about, you know, in some ways it's about a trans woman who passes. She has sort of a passing privilege. And with that, there's a kind of complexity when it comes to relationships and her relationship to the world as well. But even when I just proposed this idea to some of my professors way back when, they sort of used very derogatory language. And they were like, how would he not know that she's a da-da-da-da-da? And it's interesting for me to see this sort of older generation that has very fixed gender ideas and an understanding how they're having to kind of grapple with the fact that things are changing in an interesting way. So, yeah.
And so does Paul, it seems.
So does Paul, yeah.
What did you learn about this topic, about gender, about fluidity, as you came at it?
Yeah, well, I'm, you know, there's this sort of Jungian notion that we're all a bit of both, and that we all might be both, and part of the, you know, to be healthy is to honor both aspects of our psyche in terms of masculine and feminine, but that we live in a one-gendered body, and that there is always within everyone this sort of deep conflict between having both aspects of ourselves, but only physically expressing one. So I think that's interesting. And I think a lot about that these days, but to be honest, like, you know, transgender, the idea of it is not new. Maybe it's a new word, I don't know, but it's as old as human civilization, or as old as humans themselves. It's and it's very bizarre to me that we don't have more stories and narratives, because you know, trans people are kind of everywhere. They're participating in society, and it feels strange that they should be kind of not outside of a collective narrative, that they should not be able to participate in that.
Going back to story, why is it important for you to contribute this story to a narrative, to a general narrative?
I mean, there's so many reasons. Like, even Lena, our actress, has never seen a story where someone like her is loved. Can you imagine spending your entire life not seeing someone that you can identify with in a full way being loved? So she watches it and she sees suddenly a narrative that she's always longed to see, like, oh my God, I'm lovable, and here's a story of someone who wants to love me. And then she's playing in it herself, and she, for her, it's just the most emotional moment, because she, it's there's so many, I mean, there's just a lot, there's just, I've learned so much on this project for sure, but just the lack of representation in a sort of collective conscious narrative space is sort of shocking if you realize how many people need it. And also just the idea of a white guy loving a black woman. When I asked our associate producer, her name is Yari, and she's also a trans woman of color, and I'm like, because she really thinks that this is touching on something very important, and I'm like, for me, I'm like, why, you know? Because for me, this seems like an obvious sort of story to tell. And she's like, when was the last time you saw that? And I couldn't give her an answer, and I just don't understand why. I just don't understand why these stories don't exist. Like, does that make sense? It seems like such a natural thing to talk about, because it's in the world. It's in the world. These stories are taking place. They're happening. I don't know why they don't exist, why they're not represented. So, yeah. I don't know if I'm answering your question. There's a lot of things to talk about on that dimension, but yeah.
You are. I think the idea of Lena sitting there and seeing herself reflected literally, mm-hmm. and figuratively is a powerful image.
Mm-hmm.
So, for sure. Well, look, Danielle, thank you so much for taking the time.
For sure. Thank you.